I thought it was really important to frame my ramblings today and our discussion in a little while with Scripture, because I believe that the Bible has a lot to teach us. I'm sure you do as well. And I wanted to read a couple of verses from the very beginning and the very end of Scripture, which I think really help us to frame our conversations within this space of considering conflict, refugees, religious freedom. That's what I wanted to chew on a bit more today in this session. And I'm delighted. Thank you so much, Milius, for all that you shared with us in that preceding session, because I feel as if you've said so much of what I was going to say, and that's wonderful, because I will now add a little bit more and we will build on that for the conversations as we go through the day. So in Genesis chapter 1 verse 27, beautiful, beautiful words. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God he created them, male and female. He created them. That's the important basis where we start. God created us and those that went before us and those that are coming after us. That's what he did. And at the end of Scripture in Revelation 21, these marvellous, marvellous words, as we look for that distant future, a new heaven and a new earth. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. In Revelation 21 verses 1 to 5. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of the heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the older things, the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. Amen. I just love that sense of what's to come. What's to come, in spite of the mess that we see around us in 2015 today. That is the reality. There's two other sets of verses in between, in the middle two sections of that PowerPoint, I think are really important principles as well. For me, personally, for those involved in mission, perhaps for every single one of us, the challenge is as spelt out by Jesus himself as he quoted Isaiah 61. That passage in Luke 4, when Jesus declared, this is an exciting moment, wasn't it, when he said these words, when he kind of came out and said, this is who I am. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. And in that context, as we're reminded, very familiar words in Proverbs 31, you know, there's a job for us to do as we are the ones speaking out on behalf of others. I say that as a really important foundation, because I think it's so often that we get mixed up or embedded into whether it's the theory of what's going on in the world around us, or we get so overwhelmed by the emotion of what's happening around us. Maybe we feel browbeaten and destroyed. Maybe we feel it's a hopeless situation, all that is around us, and particularly when we consider ISIL and their activities in Syria and Iraq and their ambitions. Who are we, the 14 of us in this room, who are we? What can we do? What is our part to play? How are we representative in the church today? Let me just introduce to you a little bit about who I am. This is not me, this is my wife, Emma. We lived in Afghanistan for about the best part of 10 years, and she put this book around by choice, not because she was required to, because as a foreign woman she could get away with just wearing a chadar, just the head cover, but the Afghan women had to wear a chadari, this awful blue nylon thing which is so hot in the heat of the day. We I'm a helicopter avionics engineer originally. Obvious credentials for coming and speaking about religious freedom in the Middle East. I know you're saying that. I know you're thinking that. The one thing, I did learn many things from my helicopter days, but one thing I learned is about looking at a set of problems and trying to look at scenarios and how to figure out what the best possible ways of dealing with this multiplex of problems are. And I think that in our time in Afghanistan, we were immensely privileged, because of the places that we found ourselves as relatively youngsters. Emma and I were in our mid-20s when we first went to Afghanistan. And yet the places that we went and the conversations that we had with senior Talibs and government people in order to try to try and be peacemakers in all that we did was a part of what we talked about a lot and lived out. And I'll come back to more of that in a while. We met in a refugee camp in the middle of Goma in DRC back in the mid-90s. So when the mess of the Hutus and the Tutsis were killing each other, that's where Emma and I met. So an interesting place. We've always had a bit of a... we've always loved life as a couple, and we then added some extras along. So we've got three daughters who are bigger than that now, but this was when we were in Cairo some years ago. So we're a family of five, and we spend our whole life really in this pursuit of crazy things, I suppose. And we find ourselves, oops, let's click onto the next one. We found ourselves driving Land Rovers across parts of the world, and we found ourselves living in parts of Africa. And these days, for the last 10 years, we've been based in London and Oxford and Essex and different parts of the UK, involved in, as Bob said, Release International. I led that work for a good 6.5 years. Then I led a vulnerable children's charity called Viva. And now I'm working with Christian Solidarity Worldwide, which is about standing up for religious freedom in the world, using human rights mechanisms to tackle these problems, whether it's at the United Nations or with our government in the UK, United States, or many other parts of the world. I'll weave in a bit about CSW later on. But I wanted to ponder a little bit on the fact that we're in a bit of a mess, aren't we, in the world today? And whilst it's been glorious to celebrate peace, that we haven't had a world war since 1945, but actually the world hasn't become a beautifully peaceful place. I spent some time living in South Sudan and in Darfur, and it breaks my heart that the conflicts there aren't resolved, far from it. Mm-hmm. They are still rumbling beneath the surface. But how often do you hear about Sudan and South Sudan in our news? How often is it in our mind, in the public's eye? It's just not there, is it? Yeah. And perhaps one of the key reasons for that is, well, there's very little interest that the Western world has in those parts of the world. There's not quite the same oil interest, for instance, in Darfur, although that's an interesting, you know, the Chinese have been busy, in as the rest of the world has been quiet and not watching. You look at Somalia, into Ethiopia and Eritrea, and across the peninsula there as well, into Yemen. And in that whole area, you've got such a mass of fundamentalist groups. Al-Shabaab is active and really, really pushing out as they spread into Kenya and far beyond. But it doesn't just end there. The wars and rumours of wars pop up all over. You think of the Sinai Peninsula, part of the Egypt landmass, and it's the place where over the last 15-20 years or so, the place where most people have been trafficked through that place into Europe. But it's also a place that's immensely unstable now. Immensely. We know about in the news, of course, much to do with the Middle East and all that's happening, particularly in Iraq and in Syria, with the rise of the Islamic State, so-called Daesh, and then also interesting engagements, involvements with Iran and so on. I wanted to read you an extract from a message I had this morning about some of the awful things that are happening in Syria today. My friend was reflecting on the fact that only a few weeks ago, really, we've had a range of Ethiopians and Eritreans on a beach and murdered and videoed. We've had a range of Egyptians similarly. In Tunisia, we've had tourists slaughtered. And a few days ago, there was also three Syrians, Christians, who were shot, and then three others, as an example, said, if you don't pay the ransom, these are next. The Christians identified themselves, and these are human beings, let's remember now. The Christians identified themselves as Asher Abraham of Tel Tamar village, Bassam Issa Michael of Tel Shamarim village, and Dr. Abdul Masih Enwia of Jazeera village. Human beings, men just like us. After they were shot, three other Christians were shown kneeling in the sand behind the bodies of the just executed men. And as with the video's first segment, the men are made to recite their names in an apparently scripted moment. One of the Christians then points to the bodies on the ground and says, "Our fate is the same as these if you do not take proper procedure for our release. The three men who were killed and the three men that remained were part of a group of at least 250 Assyrians who were abducted by Islamic State in February 2015, when the group pushed through the Khabar River Valley in Hasakah province and attacked dozens of Assyrian villages. Islamic State later released 48 hostages, and it has demanded a total of more than $10 million for all of those abducted. Islamic State gave no deadline, but said that if the ransom isn't paid, the remaining hostages would be executed." The video comes days after the Islamic State released another video about the so-called submission tax, the jizya, imposed upon Christians in the town of Al-Karamatin. They attacked on August the 5th, and all but defeating it in the same day. The video shows Islamic State fighters demolishing parts of church buildings and destroying religious-themed paintings after the takeover of the town. And if it is that those Christians that remain are allowed to live, the thing that they need to sign is these following conditions. Listen to this list of 11 conditions that I'll read out to you. Number one, Christians may not build churches, monasteries, or hermitages in the city or in the surrounding areas. They may not show the cross or any of their books in the Muslim streets or markets, and may not use amplifiers when worshipping during prayers. They may not recite from their books or ring church bells loud enough for the Muslims to hear. They may not carry out any act of aggression against Islamic State, such as harbouring spies and criminals. If they come to know of any plot against Muslims, they must report it. They must not perform religious rituals in public. They must respect Muslims and not criticise their religion. Wealthy Christians must pay an annual jizya submission tax of 4 gold dinars, currencies, country was unspecified. Middle class Christians must pay 2 gold dinars and the poor must pay 1. Christians must disclose their income and may split the jizya into 2 payments. They may not own any guns. They may not engage in business activity involving pigs or alcohol with Muslims or in a Muslim market. And they may not drink alcohol in public. They will maintain their own cemeteries. They must abide by Islamic State dress code and commerce guidelines. Imagine that. So that's what's happening today in Islamic State territories, as they expand their empire. I find this gentleman very interesting. Assad in Syria, so much British influence, his wife of course as well, and yet it's such a mixed picture to know quite what to make of him. Of course, in days before 2003, when the Americans invaded Iraq, somehow Syria was fairly stable. And there's a big argument to say, well, why did we disturb the way things were? Of course, with the benefit of hindsight, we all have 20/20 vision. But this man, if nothing else, he's a man we should pray for, because he is such an incredibly influential man. And I think more than just the obvious, with regards to interactions or attacks with rebels and with Islamic State and what the coalition of which the state leads is doing to try and remove him, but also now the involvement of Russia in the mix. What quite are their intentions? Quite a mystery, perhaps. But also, if you look back at what the purpose of the Russian Federation and the Soviet Union in that time when it was very active is all about, it's very clear. It's about an imperialistic invasion. We take over the world and we grow the empire. That is very clear in the way in which they operate. That is their intention. So quite what Russia's involvement is going to be as a nation that has until quite recently been growing quite rapidly, particularly as oil prices have gone up. Interesting to see what the impact has been with the price of the barrel of oil having subsided in recent times, and what is going to happen again when oil prices recover. But he is a key player in all of this. And of course he represents a rare breed, doesn't he? Because most other so-called dictators and leaders have been removed and many have been killed. But he's still there. He's still in some semblance of power. Milius talked a lot about, he touched on, should I say, Palestine and Israel and the whole picture. And it struck me that one of the big things that we are seeing today is something about the world that is putting pressure on the Middle East, particularly, is seeking to bring kind of a homogenous kind of entity. But in reality, we've always had differences. And the challenge, I would argue, is that we celebrate differences while also celebrating our potential overlaps. We must accept that, of course, within the Middle East, there are huge numbers of languages spoken. And, of course, this issue, I think, is really important. We should never underplay this, that there is a desire for a united Arab state. And, of course, within Islam, there is the eschatological aim that the establishment of the pure Islamic state is part of the end times. Echoes, of course, with Revelation and what we seek as looking forward to the second coming. I think also another major factor, which we might unpack a bit more, is the issue of natural resources. I commented, perhaps rather flippantly, about is the West interested in oil in South Sudan and in Darfur? But I think we should underestimate at our peril the impact of oil within the whole playing field, the whole arena. I think it's fair to say that Iran and Iraq are different, quite different really, from perhaps Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, because the Emirates and Saudi have capitalised upon their own oil, and Iran and Iraq have perhaps been misused by other players big time. This is a different proportion. You can see that sort of the scaling of this map is. It shows the importance in terms of world terms of who has the oil and therefore which are the nations which are the most important, arguably. Obviously, Saudi Arabia is at the centre of this. They are the big players. They are the ones that have the power with regards to oil. And interestingly, they are the United States are the biggest user, but they're also tiny in comparison. So Canada has its own oil reserves, but not so much of a user because of the dispersed population. But it is notable to see, I think, Nigeria is an interesting one. Perhaps we'll come on to talk about Boko Haram and all that's going on there in a moment. I think also what we are seeing in the Middle East is a change of landscape. There's like tectonic plates moving. And when you remove key players, when you see Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein moved out of the picture, that vacuum, maybe this is obvious, but that vacuum gets filled very easily by radical elements. It is the way that it is. And an interesting mix, of course, in this as well is what the ambitions of Turkey are with regards to their place in Europe or not in Europe, and the gateway on the Silk Road into the rest of Asia. Very interesting how still in Iran and Syria, you've got the power play of individuals still. And yet, in other countries, it's a different agenda altogether. I think it's fair to say that Islamic traditions have a big part to play. I spent a bit of time in Baghdad a few years ago with my old friend Andrew White, and we went, and this was an amazing opportunity, we went and spent some time in Najaf. And Najaf, for those that know, is the centre of Shia Islam. It's where the tomb of Imam Ali is. And as a non-Muslim, I felt immensely privileged to be allowed into this holy place and even to the tomb of Imam Ali. Of course, they didn't realise that I was singing praises and praying in my head and in my heart the whole time. But an amazing privilege to be there in such a place. But one of the... I'll come onto a photograph of a person in a minute, but it's very interesting, I think, the questions that were asked by some of the Shia clerics. But we in our naivety, perhaps, in the West, and in our attempts to try and bring simple solutions to complex problems, we kind of assume that Islam is homogenous. And I think, why do we think that as a nation? That is kind of immensely crazy. And we somehow also really think to ourselves that Islam is a bit like treated like religion in the Western construct, that actually it's an appendage to the rest of life. But of course, within Islam, politics, jurisprudence, the economy, religion, culture, it's all part of the same bubble. And at our peril, we ignore that. It is fascinating to see the rise, the dramatic rise of anti-Western feeling in the Islamic world. I'm sure that's been exacerbated by the incursions of foreign troops. But what else has been going on? Whether it's been just the oil position, whether it's been the naivety of culture, very interesting to see how that is much more complex. I just wanted to touch very briefly on Lebanon, because I think Lebanon has a very interesting part to play, especially in a context today where they have so many refugees from Syria within their country. And yet it wasn't that long ago there was a civil war in 1975, and it's lasted until about 1990. That's an amazing recent history when there was chaos in Lebanon. They have, as you well know, a big history that the challenges since the mid-1948 have been absolutely immense. And Lebanon as a nation is, if we didn't have Lebanon placed where it is responding to the crisis, we would be in a lot more complex position today. I wanted to quote you, back in 2003, there was a group within the United Kingdom called Enabling Christians to Serve Refugees. And this was a kind of a business plan. And this is some of the highlights, that the world that it looked at that time. So between 2000 and 2002, so we're talking between 13 and 15 years ago, the United Kingdom received 301,600 asylum applications. And that was the highest figure among all industrialised countries. The countries that they came from were the United Kingdom, were Zimbabwe, and where's it gone? Zimbabwe and Somalia. Afghanistan, Somalia, Iraq and Zimbabwe, yeah. And it's amazing, really, to think that's what the situation was then. And causes that they came with included conflict, human rights abuse, and environmental problems, as well as persecution. That was 15 years ago. And today we are in a situation where it is immensely more complex than that, and numbers are a lot higher. And in the UK, of course, we just see the tip of the iceberg, because it's a long way on the road for which these asylum seekers travel. The Silk Road, I think, is really important. I just mentioned Turkey there for a moment, but the route through Turkey and through Iran, the trade routes, the old trade routes, the language is the same language of Iran and Afghanistan, there's the Persian dialect of Farsi in Iran and Dari in Afghanistan. And along these routes, of course, you've got the Alexander the Great, and you've got Genghis Khan, and all these big characters from the past, they would travel along these routes. They would pass ideas along the whole way through. They would be making babies and children all the way along through. They would be influencing countries big time, which, and you see remnants of that today, interestingly. The Hazara people in the centre of Afghanistan look very mongoloid with their eyes in the images that Genghis Khan would have looked like in our history books. The influence is phenomenal, for good and for bad. And whoever controls that region, they are the ones, they're the gatekeepers. They not only charge the fees, and of course today we talk about tax and trade barriers, but also they are the ones that allow permission, give permission for the movement of goods and people throughout that route into the rest of the Middle East as well. Obviously, historically, you have silk and spices, and the curious knock-on of that of thinking through why is it that actually Afghanistan is today the biggest producer of opium? Well, it's not only because the terrain is very dry and arid and can produce this, but the market is demanding it, and so it pulls that through the Silk Road back into Europe and North America. And the only kind of alternative crop to opium is saffron, but of course there isn't the need or the demand for saffron within those trade routes, and therefore if it was the case, then the price of saffron would also drop and then it would not be a viable alternative. Returning to Iran for a brief moment, I think it's important to remember that Iran, not only through its turbulent history through the 50s and the 70s and ending with Ayatollah Khomeini declaring Iran as an Islamic Republic, but the oil factor in Iran and the ideological, artistic, culture strength of Iran have had such a phenomenal impact upon the whole of the Middle East and into Asia. But also, there's been times when the tensions between Sunni and Shia Islam have been huge. It's been relatively quiet, I suppose, in recent times. It's all relative, isn't it? And of course, interesting, fascinating to see how relationships now with the West have seemingly warmed up. We seem to be becoming friends again. And yet, I think we should never ever underestimate that actually things might look new, but they're not necessarily as strong or as robust or as open as you assume. There's an adage in Afghanistan, we always would say you can never buy an Afghan, but you can always rent one. And the same applies in Iran. People will always follow an ideology or always appear to be the new person in whatever ideology is emerging. But they're not. They might physically look like that, but inside they're not at all. And literally, Afghans change their hats and they shave their beards because physical appearance is important to give the message to those that are around you that, of course, yes, I embrace it. But at the same time, Iranians and Afghans have a long history and they never forget. They're like winning the poo, perhaps. You know, we talk about a mourn in that sense. But no. The fact of the matter is that I think Iran has not only a kind of a victim mentality in many ways because of feeling hard done by the way in which the British have treated them in years gone by and latterly Americans, also with regards to the oil issues of not being able to use oil to develop the nation in a trading manner, being as it's on the Silk Route again, and it's been abused by those that have taken hold of the assets of the country and use it for their own particular benefits. Islamic fundamentalism, have to make a mention of it here, you know, it has been an increasing issue in the world that we live in today. I remember back in the early 90s when I first went to Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, of course Islamic fighters, their whole focus was about doing away with the Russian kind of poison that had been imported into the country. That's the perception that they had, and they wanted to cleanse the country of all of that so-called cultural revolution, cultural involvement, and return it to the best of what it should be, i.e. back to Islamic principles. Orthodoxy became fundamentalist. The notion of returning to the foundations of scripture, whichever the religion is, I would put out to you, is never a bad thing, but it's when orthodoxy moves to militantism and fundamentalism where the danger starts. Also a country, of course, the delights of Iraq. Saddam, that delightful picture of him there with a big beard and the handsome man next to him. I think, again, we should never underestimate those words. Was it George W. Bush that said, "We got him"? You know, whatever it was when they finally found Saddam. That was just the start of a whole deeper complexity. I remember us as workers in Afghanistan trying our hardest to relate to the coalition forces, the military personnel, and saying, please would you allow us to help you understand the culture of what's going on here? And their response was, we've got it sorted, hearts and minds, that's our philosophy. Don't worry, we know what we're doing. It's incredible how, even in recent times, perhaps the same, the people that followed those people have actually accepted. They said, if only we'd listened to you. If only we had taken the time to have those conversations, things would indeed be very different. Of course, Saddam has a long history himself, and I'm sure you know a lot about all of that. But the point here is this last one I want to just mention about violence between Sunnis and Shiite Muslims, hampering efforts of building again within the region. You've got to go back to 654 when Muhammad died, and you look at the establishment of the twin track within Islam, the arguments that there were within Medina and Mecca about the who has the succession, who is the follow-on person to Muhammad, who is it that could possibly follow this prophet? And war began within Islam. War, I would suggest, that has been at the heart of the way in which Islam has continued to spread and diversify throughout history. And yet also, that warring kind of fighting and getting an upper hand has been something that has been creating so much destruction within Islam, but also with other religions as well. We only see that, with the persecuted church in countries such as Pakistan, where Christians are marginalised and persecuted. But it's fair to say that the vast majority of people that die at the hands of religious persecution in Pakistan, the vast majority of shrines and buildings that are destroyed are Islamic shrines, because they're destroyed by one another. It's not, the Christian destruction is less than the Islamic destruction, bizarre as it may seem. Okay, we've been going for 27 minutes, and I want to give you a bit of a break now. And we're going to have a little quiz in a moment. So prepare your mind for a response to some questions. But I wanted you to enjoy the delights of Buttermere in the Lake District. A nice place. I love walking there. But I don't know if you've noticed what's in the foreground of that picture. A piece of barbed wire. Now, that, as I took that picture, I didn't even notice that barbed wire, first of all. But it made me think afterwards about what can appear to be really beautiful can be made more complex by other factors that are at play in the picture. But if we focus too much on the barbed wire, we miss the beauty beyond. And that will be a tragedy, to just focus on the barbed wire and realise that's it. We can't go beyond that. Well, of course we can find ways around that, over it, in it. And it reminded me of whatever the situation is, a bit like why I read Genesis 1 and Revelation 21, whatever the problems that we have in our world today, and I believe peace and reconciliation has a massive part to play, whatever the messes that we read about or we encounter ourselves, there is always hope, because the one who we are hopeful in has won the victory. Absolutely, he has. Yeah, forgive me, I love the Lord, and I want to declare that in every moment that I can. So there's some questions for us to answer here. Maybe share of hands could answer them. So what share of the world's population is affiliated with a religion of some kind? Do we think it might be 64%, 74%, 84%, or 94%? And just want to say that it's not always the biggest number. That isn't always the answer. So what do we think? So affiliated with some kind of religion, who thinks it might be 64%? Okay, 1, 2. 74%? Okay, 1. 84? Okay, maybe a few more. And 94. So 84 seems to be the generally accepted result, and you're right. So 84% of the world, imagine that number. Imagine that in the context of our politicians and those that would try and remove the name Christmas from our streets and say this is winter festivals. Actually, 84% of the people in the world are in some way connected with religion. This data, by the way, came from a Pew Forum survey in January 2014. And there's a web link if you wanted it. Okay, next question. How many people live in countries with a high or very high restriction on their religious freedom? I'm not really defining that very well, but imagine some kind of significant restriction on their religious freedom. Do we think, and think about the world's population, what, 6.5 billion thereabouts? 2.1 billion, who thinks it might be that? Nobody? 3.1, just under half, yeah. 4.1, just over half, or 5.1. Okay, so it is actually 5.1 billion people. That's a large proportion of the world's population live in countries where there is some kind of high or very high restrictions on their religious freedom. Okay, just a couple more questions to go. People have been imprisoned for their religion-related activities. Remember, this is looking at all faiths, not just Christianity. People have been restricted, have been imprisoned for their religion-related activities. In what share of the world's countries? So this is the number of countries here we're talking about. Who thinks it's 11%? Nobody? 21%? 31%? And 41%. Okay, it's not quite as high as you think. It is actually 31%. So just under a third of the countries in the world. And this is a nice easy question to answer here. So it's estimated how many Christians are persecuted for their faith today? Who thinks it might be 50 million? 100 million? 150? 200? It's probably all the numbers, of course. This survey says, oops, well there's the thingy, the root of it. This survey said 200 million. It's really difficult to put your finger on exactly how many people are persecuted and how many are connected into conflict-related persecution as opposed to pressures from the other religions or the nationalist agenda, as you see in countries like India. But it is a huge number of people, isn't it? I would challenge you, if you saw one group of 50 million and then 2 or 3 days later you saw another group of 200 million, you probably couldn't differentiate. They're just a mass of people. Huge. Okay, we're just going to touch on a few other themes here, and then I want to stop and we can have a chat a bit more about it, see what questions we've got. This is a reality, of course. This is the pressure that is the world of persecution and religious freedom, alongside that world of increased migration out of conflict situations. And those conflict situations are not just about civil war, they're not just about one party against another party, they're multifaceted conflicts, often triggered by the removal of key characters. This is the world that we live in today. In many countries it has a specific outcome, and we've talked a little bit about Iraq and Syria and Iran already. So I'm going to skip over a couple of these pictures here. I wanted to introduce you to a couple of my friends. And this fellow up here is a guy who I'll call John. And he's one of my friends in Afghanistan. And he's probably about 55 now. And his father was he's retired now, but was a senior official within the civil service equivalent in Afghanistan, working very closely with one of the government departments. And all of his brothers have incredibly high jobs, whether in non-governmental organisations or in other businesses in Afghanistan. But about 15 or so years ago, John decided to become a Christian. And that was the start of great trouble for him in his life. And yet, he is a man who has had many opportunities to decide to go back to Islam, but he's decided that he has the authentic experience of God at work in his life, that his argument to me is, I could never go back, I could never pretend. And he is one of thousands upon thousands of people like him in Afghanistan today. He's also one of many that have exited Afghanistan and gone to seek their life in some other place. But he represents an interesting cadre of people in Afghanistan who need in some ways to remain. One of the struggles that we have in many countries today, because the church is moving and migrating, there is a big problem with the church being extracted, as it were, from the context. I wanted to read you a couple of quotes from an interesting Lebanese author whose name's Hannah Nouri Joshua, who's based in the UK now, but he reflects upon the state of the church in the Middle East today. And he says this about the church now. In the middle of the decade of the 21st century, i.e. 2015, the world is confronted with an Islamic world that is undergoing a very turbulent, agonising, barbarous, intolerant and dreadful time, hardly witnessed before in its history. It extends from the Indian subcontinent through the Middle East and across North Africa. Ancient regimes are collapsing. Countries are disintegrating. Sectarian and ethnic and racial conflicts are rising to the surface and are flaring up everywhere. Tribes and adherents to certain religious groups, especially the targeted native Christian population, are being forcibly deported and coerced to leave their native countries. They seem to have been shocked and dismayed at the situation. An ISIS video entitled "A Message Signed with Blood of the Nation of the Cross" was released on the 15th of February 2015, showing the beheading of the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians for the first time outside of Syria and Iraq. This undeniably means, a Flashpoint report said, that the group now views Christian populations not only as targets, but also as part of the bigger Crusader plot, so-called, not separate from the US-led coalition or aggressors. The group's message is highly intimidating and in some way challenges Western nations to intervene to save Christians as it intervened to save the Yazidis and others. There's a move afoot at the moment to bring a group of mainly Christians to send a cruise ship or two into the region and extract the Christians from the region. Now, on one hand, that is, of course, compassion at its very best to save the lives of those Christians. But on the other hand, you do two things there. First of all, you focus all the Christians in one ship. What an easy target that would be to destroy. But also, you remove the church, the remnant, from the Middle East. And it will be immensely difficult to return that. Back in 2011, and the European Parliament itself expressed its concerns in a resolution saying this about Christians in the Middle East. The European Union condemns the recent attacks on Christian communities in various countries and expresses its solidarity with the families of the victims, expresses its deep concerns about the proliferation of episodes of intolerance, repression and violent events directed against Christian communities, particularly in the countries of Africa, Asia and the Middle East. So the European Union said that, and then you think, well, what have they done? What have they put in place as to go beyond words? And finally, I just wanted to read a few words from Pope Francis as he reflected upon the situation today. These are words that he said very recently. "Most of you live among a Muslim majority," who's speaking to Christians in the Middle East. "With your ability to differentiate, you can help your Muslim fellow citizens to show an authentic picture of Islam that many of them wish for, who continually say that Islam is a religion of peace and is in accordance with respect for human rights and demand that everyone can live together. That will be useful to them and to the whole society." Now that's quite profound, isn't it? Pope Francis was saying that actually, if you Muslims that talk about peace, religion, Islam being a religion of peace, then make it so. Speak it out. Make sure that your representative groups are speaking that. Well, it's not coherent. It's not a voice that is being amplified within Islam, whether in the Shia or Sunni circles or in other Ahmadiyyas or other places. There are isolated voices, but there isn't a together voice. I spent some time, as I said earlier on, in Baghdad, and it was delightful to meet special people and to have fun together. I met this gentleman here. This is Al-Hakimi, who is one of the Grand Majuria in Najaf, one of the select group that are the leaders of Shia Islam in the world. And this was in 2010, when I was sat in his front room. And he said to me in 2010, "So what's the church doing to support its people in Syria? What interest does the West have in solving the problem that is evident in Syria today?" And in 2010, I was thinking, Syria isn't a problem, is it? What's happening with Syria? He was a man who was incredibly well informed, knew exactly what was going on, and some of the rumblings under the surface. And as a senior Islamic cleric, he was challenging me as somebody that's part of the Western Church. And he was basically saying, you're doing nothing. What are you doing? That memory stuck with me and will do forever. And I think, as Pope Francis talks to Muslims within majority Muslim countries and challenges them to be agents of peace and love within their own circles. I would challenge us as the church in the West that actually we need to follow the advice of people like Al-Hakim and be agents of peace where we are. One of the tragedies that I experienced when I went to Nigeria a few years ago, and I've been a few times, was to meet with senior, and I say this with great sadness really, senior clerics, senior church leaders within the Anglican Church in Nigeria, and they had such little knowledge of Islam. They really had very, very little knowledge. And yet, Muslims were their neighbours, literally their neighbours. And there's this fear that had built up, the assumption, the fear of assumption that actually Muslims are terrible and somehow alien. And equally so, within the Islamic communities, they didn't understand what Christians were about either. It's so tragic when people don't take time to listen and understand one another. In our own country, I have to think about this in where I live, and I think, how much time do we spend in Oxford? How much time do we spend getting to know the imams of the mosque on the Cowley Road and spending time as Christians within our cities? We might be accused by others of somehow watering down our faith. Well, hold on a minute. Surely we need to see people as human beings. And if we hope for them to understand us, then we must seek to understand them as well. I want to come to the end because I could talk forever. But you're probably familiar with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the 23 articles that encompass in there from 1948, the 10th of December 1948. And, Article 18 is what we live and breathe in our work, but it's becoming a more and more important principle in the world today because people are realising that there's a fundamental touchstone connection between freedoms of religious expression with freedoms to convert, with freedoms to worship, in light of the fact that you bring stability to a region, you allow trade to flow, that ancient silk route that has stalled can be rejuvenated. And these are the words from Article 18, you've got it on the screen there. So everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief in freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship and observance. Of course, the tension comes there in terms of changing religion, because most Muslim traditions, Islamic traditions, would not agree that that is possible. As we come to the end of my bit, I just want to skip to the end here. I'm going to skip over all these fancy slides that I could talk a lot more about, and come to a really important brief passage in scripture. To know these amazing words in Deuteronomy 31 verse 6, that we can be confident of this. We can be strong and courageous, and do not be afraid or terrified because of them, for the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Those are the words that people like my friend John in Afghanistan clings on to for very life, because he knows deep in his heart that the sovereign Lord that he has committed his life to is faithful and will never leave him. And this is the hope that we have as Christians, as we are seeking to be agents of transformation, building peace, building hope, and helping people to understand the context within which we operate in. This isn't a hopeless situation. This absolutely, there is hope. And this is the time for us as a church to rise up. Thank you.
Thank you.